The cure for the common cyber attack, training cops to talk it out, and a trip through time to Silicon Prairie. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl for just one more day. It's Friday, June 12th. Thanks for being here. We start, as we always do on Fridays, with the weekly wrap. Today, I'm joined by Nila Richardson of Redfin and Cardiff Garcia of the blog FT Alphaville. Nila and Cardiff, hello.
Hi, Molly.
Hey, Molly.
Hi there. Okay, so here's what I'm pretty sure I saw happening on C-SPAN today. The House voted against the TAA, the assistance part of this trade package that was up for a vote today, but they voted for Trade Protection Authority. So against the TAA, for the TPA, but without the TAA, the TPA cannot go forward, and then perhaps the TPP could even be in trouble. Maybe, Nila, you can help break it down a little more than that.
I feel like something was torpedoed, to use another T.
Nice.
And that could be the deal in itself. Look, traditionally, Democrats have voted for the TAA, which gives protections for workers in the face of a free trade agreement. They didn't this time. And so that is kind of weird. But what they did vote for is fast-track authority. But you needed both to see a TPP deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, go through. Mm-hmm. So right now, Congress is at a standstill. There's going to be another vote next week on Tuesday. So what we can expect is there's going to be a lot of arm-wringing, hand-holding, and whispering and cajoling going on over the weekend in D.C.
Maybe more from the president. Cardiff, what do you think? Was it a little cynical? The president said it was cynical for Democrats to vote against assistance to basically bring down the TPA,
well,
to prevent that from going forward.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of multiple layers to unravel here. I mean, in the first place, this shows the danger of connecting the two. I mean, it's perfectly consistent to be in favor of more trade, and it's perfectly okay to be in favor of more assistance for people who are out of work, for a bigger economic safety net. And yet, when you combine the two, you bring up all these kinds of political complications involved here, right? So I think, from what I understand, that's going to happen next week is that the Republicans are going to try again. But it raises the question of just why Democrats who voted against it this week would vote for it next week. Mm-hmm. And because this was a crucial component of the package, and because the measures that were voted for by the House differ from what was voted for by the Senate, it looks like for now there's really going to be an uphill struggle for the White House to get this through. So I think it's really unfortunate. This is a fascinating deal. It's a different kind of trade deal, but it got bogged down in the same old kinds of arguments about trade. And I think that's really too bad.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that what we saw today was a lot of maneuvering and maybe not a lot of good governance.
Well, that's rare in Washington, isn't it?
Good point. Let's move on quickly. I want to talk a little bit about what we've been calling all week sort of mixed messages in the economy. We got a decent jobs report. We got good consumer sentiment today, that consumer sentiment seems to be up. Clearly, consumers want to believe that we are in a good place. But there are fears over interest rates. There are still maybe mediocre wages, falling oil prices that didn't lead to consumer spending. What's the status of the recovery, would you say, Cardiff?
You know, we're getting nascent signs that the kind of consumption that we expected earlier in the year, or maybe even at the end of last year, it's finally starting to show up. So let's put this in the context of what happened with oil prices, right? We knew that oil in the near term would have sort of uncertain effects, but we expected that over time, people would start to spend the money they saved on lower gas prices, on lower oil prices. But it didn't happen. And we got all these kind of mixed signals in the first quarter in particular that were really quite confusing. But now it seems like the picture's clearing up a little bit. Employment is growing again strongly. People are starting to save that money. So I'm actually somewhat optimistic that, in fact, what happened in the first quarter when we were all so worried is actually just a blip, that it might have been a statistical issue or whatever, but it was temporary, and now the economy is starting to show signs of health again.
And Nila, what do you think? Do people feel good out on the streets?
People will feel good now. They may not feel good later. And I'll dive into that a little bit more. I think we are recovering, as Cardiff suggests. But I think we're going to see a lot more volatility, both in our economic indicators and also in the stock market. You know, as soon as the Fed lifts their foot off that pedal, mm-hmm. the economy is going to start behaving like the economy always does. And that means a bit unpredictably and a little more volatile than most people have become accustomed to. And that's going to take some getting used to, not just for consumers, but also for businesses as well.
Mixed messages are the new norm. Thank you so much, Nila and Cardiff.
Thank you.
You got it.
On Wall Street today, not much good news to report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So it sounds like that hack of federal employee data could be much bigger and much worse than previously disclosed, making it basically just like every big cyber attack in the past year or two. And that reveals a new truth about cybersecurity. Breaches are just an everyday affliction in life now. And for the business of security, that means a shift from prevention to detection and mitigation. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
These days, data breaches are a little like the flu. Stomach-churning, head-splitting, and there's no foolproof way to prevent getting sick.
It's impossible to, you know, live in a bubble and do business.
That's Greg Young, a security researcher at Gartner.
As long as you have technology and you have people, unless you have neither of those, you know, you are at risk.
That doesn't take businesses off the hook for good hygiene. Just like you and I still wash our hands, even get a flu shot to try to avoid getting whacked, companies have to do the same to avoid a breach. Josh Goldfarb is with the cybersecurity company FireEye.
People still need preventative type equipment and preventative type devices.
But now he says cybersecurity firms are looking beyond those basics.
They're realizing that they need to also focus on the subject of detection and response.
Cybersecurity is now the hand soap and the doctor and the Tamiflu. But the new reality that companies will get hacked, will get sick, means there's a growing business cleaning up the mess. Take cyber insurance.
It's growing incredibly fast.
Robert Shaker is with the cybersecurity firm Symantec.
Some companies who don't currently have a cyber insurance department are creating them. Customers are flocking to their brokers to ask for this type of coverage.
And coughing up some cash to pay for it. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Speaking of security, if you're creating backups for critical energy infrastructure, you might think about things like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But what about the power grid? There are these physical nodes in that system, these giant transformers, that are indispensable. And they've actually been subject to physical attack, as in shot at by snipers. So the industry has rolled out a new approach to have spares at the ready. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
If you've never thought about transformer substations, here's why they matter. Take out a relatively small number of them and the country goes dark. That's one reason utility companies are planning a sort of strategic stockpile of transformers. These are critical nodes, says Rich Lorden of the Electric Power Research Institute.
These power transformers are much bigger than the transformer that you're conceiving in your backyard that looks like a trash can up on a pole. This is the size of a school bus.
2 years ago, snipers sabotaged 17 transformers in California, knocking out a whole substation. Industry woke up and started worrying about backup equipment. It's mostly made overseas, says Peter Fox Penner of the Brattle Group Consultancy.
There's only a few manufacturers. They take months and sometimes even years to produce. Thus, if one goes out of service and there isn't a spare, you can have a long outage.
The new plan is to form a company to buy and pre-ship equipment to the U.S. The money would come from fees paid by utilities. It's all part of what Brian Harrell at Navigant Consulting calls an infrastructure culture shift, to be more mindful of the bad guys.
When you see a substation shooting out in Northern California or a very susceptible water treatment facility, oil refinery, all of these things look very, very attractive to terrorist elements.
He says the grid was never designed to be safe from physical attack. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Next week, Marketplace is kicking off a new series that takes a further look at our nation's infrastructure problems, so stay tuned. In the meantime, if you're job hunting, here's an interesting classified. President Obama is going to be looking for a new Librarian of Congress. Upside or maybe downside, it's basically a lifetime gig. In the over 200 years the library's been around, there have only been 13 librarians. You'll have to learn your way around the stacks of the world's biggest library and be a little techie, too. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Librarian of Congress has to wear a few hats. You're head of the Library of Congress, of course, and of its components, like the Congressional Research Service. The guy leaving the job, James Billington, has been there for almost 30 years. Some say he stayed too long, didn't let the library change with the times.
Go in the place. I've spent time in the stacks, and it can be frightening.
That's Chris Deering, a professor of political science at George Washington University. He says many of the books in those frightening stacks need to be digitized. A recent government study says the outgoing librarian, Billington, dragged his feet on that and generally let the library fall behind technologically.
It's got one foot in the 19th century and one foot tepidly in the 21st century. And so it probably needs to bring both feet into the 21st century.
So President Obama will be looking to appoint someone with some technical chops. Suzanne Thorin is the former dean of the library at Syracuse University.
A person doesn't have to be a technologist. A person needs to get a team of people who know about technology.
Okay, so you can't be a Luddite. You also have to be someone with stature who can stand up to Congress and defend the library's budget. You don't want someone who's part of the political machine. Paul Light teaches public service at New York University.
If it's a hack from Hacksville, meaning a political appointee who has earned his or her stripes through loyal political service to the President of the United States, that's an easier target.
But Light says the Library of Congress job isn't as politicized as other political appointee jobs. He says likely candidates might be university presidents, heads of major tech companies. So if you qualify, send in your resume. Hey, you never know, right? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This was a time when it really was the Wild West in tech, and where better to do that than the actual Wild West?
The creators of AMC's Halt and Catch Fire. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dumped 140 points, 0.75% to end at 17,898. The NASDAQ nosed down 31 points to close at 5051. And the S&P 500 flopped 14 points, 0.7% to finish at 2094. For the week, not such bad news. The Dow rose 0.3%, the NASDAQ fell 0.3%, and the S&P 500 ticked up less than 0.1%. Energy stocks were to blame today as crude prices fell. ExxonMobil and Chevron dribbled more than 1% lower. Okay, I'm going to stop now. Airlines looked better, though, after a research report said U.S. domestic fares are gaining some traction. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.39%, and you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, will count twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve issues its May industrial production report. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a closed briefing on lifting sanctions on Iran, practical implications. And on June 15th, 1880, a patent was issued for a safety razor. Disposables came along eventually. Still seems to be a need for those little pieces of Kleenex. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. More police officers are killed by civilians in the U.S. than in any other developed country. But at the same time, cops here are much more likely to kill civilians. Excessive and sometimes deadly use of force is a hot issue right now in America. A recent presidential commission said some of those issues could be overcome by more training for cops on diversity, on understanding the mentally ill, and just learning how to communicate. It sounds obvious, but it ain't easy. As part of our series, Behind the Blue Line, The Costs of a Changing Police Force, Sally Herships looks at police training in America.
When you have an emergency, you're supposed to call 911. But for some Americans, calling the police can seem just as scary as the situation you're trying to get help with.
It's a huge calculated risk.
Laura Usher is with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She says when someone is mentally ill, maybe threatening to harm themselves or others, family members can be afraid to contact police. If you're lucky, Usher says, you'll get a well-trained officer who's prepared to deal with the mentally ill.
But in a community without training, yeah, best case scenario is probably that they get arrested.
And worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario, you know, that they get shot, killed.
Which is what happened to Jason Harrison in Dallas. Harrison was 38 and had schizophrenia when his mom called the police last year. She needed help getting her son to the hospital. I'm going to play a clip of the incident from CNN, but warning, it's disturbing. According to police, when they arrived, they found Harrison holding a screwdriver. The officers involved in the shooting were not criminally charged, but Harrison's family sued. Usher says this type of scenario is what many families worry about.
That your child's going to get beaten, that he's going to get pepper sprayed, that he's going to get tasered, that he's going to get shot, that he's going to die.
Usher says while there are about 18,000 local and state police departments around the country, only about 15% do comprehensive mental health crisis training. Maki Haberfeld specializes in police training at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She says American police don't get enough training in general or enough quality training.
In other words, professional development is not where it's supposed to be. And police officers know this.
Haberfeld says they also know they've never been more scrutinized. Take all the videos that have gone viral recently, like the one last week of a confrontation between police and teenagers at a pool party in Texas.
Sir, we just came for a birthday party.
Neighbors complained that some teens were getting out of hand, but critics say it was a police officer who was out of control.
I told you, stay!
At one point, he forces a girl in a bathing suit onto the ground, face down. Then he kneels on her back. The officer who was caught on tape in the incident resigned a few days later. Kevin Dillon was a cop for more than 25 years. Now he trains them. He says before police get physical, whenever possible, they should get verbal first.
That's the ultimate warrior, the one to get his opponent to concede without using violence.
But Dillon says he also knows what he sees often, young officers who need to learn improved communication skills.
Half the time, their communication is used to doing with their hands on their phones.
Like texting. Dillon says for police, learning communication skills is key.
It takes a great deal of training to be able to understand and how to de-escalate a situation.
And then more training on how to command presence.
In another situation, how to show empathy. In another way, how to get somebody to confess that he just beat this child nearly to death. So there's – think about that range of communication skills. It's not just a matter of talking back and forth.
But Dillon says he knows budgets are tight and he knows what training costs. Anywhere from $100 for a one-day course for one officer to over $10,000 for a whole department for a week. He says when it comes to training, police just aren't getting enough. Take use of force. He says cops often get only 4 to 8 hours of training a year.
We're too reactionary. We have to start to invest now to save later. Instead of like, well, if we get sued, well, we're going to get sued. Why don't we try to minimize the outcome by trying to invest now?
But if it's your responsibility to make sure a police department runs smoothly, finding extra room in your budget for additional training can be tough.
The number one priority is always going to be respond to those 911 calls.
Sue Rahr is director of Washington State's Criminal Justice Training Commission. She was a member of the President's Task Force on Policing and was with the King County Sheriff's Office for 33 years, the last 7 as sheriff. She says those 911 calls don't stop for training.
When you send an officer to training, you have to fill that officer's shift on the street.
Police salaries differ all over the country. Barrar says when she worked in King County, it cost about $2,000 a week in overtime to cover the cost of each officer who was away at training. If she wanted to put all 700 officers through training, Rahr says you'd be talking millions. But she says even if a police department can find the money, training on its own isn't enough to create change. Remember, she says, each of the 18,000 police departments in the country have to answer to a city council or a mayor or some other elected official.
When you tell police for 30 years, we want you to be tough on crime, that culture resonates, and the message is we want you to control crime by making arrests and by doing it in a very forceful way.
Rahr says you can put police through all the training in the world, but if you don't change the tough on crime culture at the top, nothing will change. Meanwhile, budgets for additional training are often the first to be cut when funding is tight. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You've heard of Silicon Valley, probably Silicon Beach, but maybe not Silicon Prairie. Well, in the early 1980s, Texas was the place where early software developers, gamers, and entrepreneurs came looking for fortune at the height of the personal computing boom. And that is the setting for the AMC show Halt and Catch Fire, which tells the story of a band of misfits in a race to create the next big thing in tech. It's in its second season, and it's been telling some unexpected stories. Chris Rogers and Chris Cantwell created the show, and they join me now. Chris and Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
So just in case people haven't seen the show, what is Halt and Catch Fire about?
Sure. Halt and Catch Fire is kind of about the dawn of the PC era. The first season took place in 1983 and was kind of about people trying to reverse engineer an IBM PC and kind of create something great of their own in, you know, the personal computer world. The second season of Halt and Catch Fire, which began 2 weeks ago, kind of plays in the foothills of the early internet. The show is always about innovation and people trying to create the future. And usually we're trying to tell the story you don't know, not the one that took place in Silicon Valley with the big companies that kind of dominate that story now. This is kind of, we think, an untold history of tech and where we are today.
So why this time period and this specific place and this moment in history? What made you guys want to do a show about this topic?
Texas first and foremost is where I'm from, and I think it has a really interesting history that doesn't get explored a lot. Compaq reverse engineered the IBM PC in Texas. This was a time when it really was the Wild West in tech, and where better to do that than the actual Wild West? AMC, you know, had a meeting with us, and they've sat us down in the conference room, and all the executives have copies of our script. Their interest was very strong from the beginning.
Yeah, I wonder if they didn't see the same opportunity we did, which was, you know, when we learned the reverse engineering story, which essentially is why it's not an Apple or an IBM now. It was kind of like, I can't believe people don't know this because computers are such a dominant force in our lives. You know, they swung on it, and, you know, I'll be eternally grateful for that.
So talk about the, you know, you said you feel really lucky, you're very grateful. What's it like to sort of be in that environment and have that leash?
Chris and I are in our early 30s, you know, so the guys we grew up emulating are kind of came from that difficult men generation, certainly, you know, the guys who did The Wire and The Sopranos and Mad Men. So AMC had some of those landmark shows that really made us want to do this. When we started writing as a team, we exchanged the Breaking Bad pilot because it was just so well written and we were so interested. So to have the interest of AMC, which had kind of fostered and incubated a lot of the great shows in our mind that made us want to write TV, was this huge opportunity. And I think, you know, now AMC has kind of earned our trust, you know, in shows that have premises that might not immediately be obvious to you, like the reverse engineering of an IBM PC. You're willing to ride it out and kind of see where it goes and buy into the premise because it's AMC in a way that you wouldn't be willing to do, I think, on a lot of other networks.
Talk to us about season two, because season one is reverse engineering the IBM PC, creating a competitor, still getting beat. Spoiler alert. But in season two, you have two women running a startup.
Yes.
This seems like an unusual thing for us to be seeing on television and in the tech world.
Yeah, I think that in the interest of telling the story that you don't know, we thought that would be a great way into this proto-internet dial-up service world of the mid-80s. You know, per capita, there were more women getting computer science degrees and computer engineering degrees back then than there are now. And I think the narrative has been crafted in hindsight that computers are really toys for boys.
Yeah, and I think the opportunity of the whole show, not just the female characters, was to tell these kind of lesser-known legends and histories of the computer and the tech industry, because I think there is a tendency to see the whole thing through the lens of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and, you know, these garages in Silicon Valley, and it's more than that.
Chris Rogers and Chris Cantwell are the co-creators and executive producers of Halt and Catch Fire, currently in its second season on AMC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
And this final note today, we are kicking off a new podcast. It's a collaboration between Marketplace and Quartz, and it's called Actuality. It's co-hosted by our own Sabri Benashour, who's here.
Hi.
And Quartz's Tim Fernholz. Hi, Tim.
Hello there.
It sounds like there's tons going on in the first episode. Tell us all about it.
Well, Tim here just got back from Cuba, so we are taking a look at how that country is starting to dabble in capitalism. We're going to hear about how a lot of people in Cuba do the internet right now. It's basically a dude that goes door-to-door with a USB key each week with your weekly dose of downloads.
And apparently it's more efficient than HBO Go. I met people in Cuba who were more up-to-date on Game of Thrones than I was.
And in other episodes, we will talk about TV piracy, islands made out of bird poop, and genetically engineered mosquitoes.
I mean, I think I'm not alone in saying this is a can't miss.
We think so.
Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's the weekend, folks. Good thing, because it was not a great day on Wall Street. The Dow was down 0.75%, about 140 points. NASDAQ down 31 points, 0.67%. The S&P 500 flopped 14 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. Tommy Andres is acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. And I am Molly Wood. Don't worry, Kai is back on Monday. But in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter, at Molly Wood, and follow at Marketplace while you're at it. Have a good weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.